Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Daniel Dreisbach, professor of Justice, Law, and Society at American University in Washington, D.C., holding a law degree from the University of Virginia and a Ph.D. from Oxford University. Professor Dreisbach is a noted historian of religion and politics during the American colonial period and post-independence era, and has authored and co-edited a number of fine books on this topic, including Thomas Jefferson and the Wall of Separation Between Church and State, Religion and Politics in the Early Republic, Jasper Adams and the Church-State Debate, The Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life, and Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. Those last two works were co-edited with Mark David Hall, a frequent guest on our show. And although Professor Dreisbach's main research stomping ground is the year 1800, give or take a few decades, today we fast forward a little bit to examine the role of religious rhetoric in the life of Abraham Lincoln, which Daniel has written on recently in honor of the sesquicentennial of the U.S. Civil War. We're only a few days past the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's famed second inaugural address, which was one of the last public speeches Lincoln gave and is considered to be an iconic work of political rhetoric in our country's history. Professor Dreisbach has recently published some of his thoughts on this, as well as the Gettysburg Address, at the Library of Law and Liberty, which we will link to. All of this is part of his current research on the role of the Bible in public discourse, so visit us to find links to Daniel's work and some other fun tidbits, as well as joining us on Twitter and Facebook. We can be found at Facebook at Research on Religion with Anthony Gill, and our Twitter handle is RORcast, so please stop by for frequent updates. Daniel, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a joy to be here.
I'm going to start out by noting that you are not a Lincoln scholar per se. There's a lot of those that are all around the United States, and we had a few emails back and forth. You wanted me to make that clear, but I also noted in my emails that I like it when scholars step out of their narrow specialties to say things about different times and different places, because it often brings a very fresh comparative perspective to the table. Now, you are primarily known for your work on the founding era in American history. So what motivated you to venture forth and write a couple things on Lincoln?
Well, Tony, in recent years, I've been doing some research on the role of religion, and more specifically, the role and place of the Bible in the political rhetoric of the American founding period. And in the course of that research, I was oftentimes drawn to Abraham Lincoln, although he's not from that period, because he's such a gifted orator who frequently incorporated the Bible and I would say Bible-like language into his rhetoric. And so it was often interesting to me to compare how Lincoln used the Bible in his discourse with those of the American founders. And so this recent work I've been doing on Lincoln really is an outgrowth of looking more specifically at how some of our founding fathers used the Bible in their political discourse.
That is what makes you very interesting to me, because you're talking about Lincoln, but you have done most of your research on the founding era. And you're able to see, I believe, a lot more of the different trends, the similarities, and the differences that have occurred between the founding era and the Lincoln era, as compared to people who might narrowly specialize just on Lincoln and look at only the 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s. And I want to explore that a little bit before we get into talking about Lincoln's rhetoric per se, but give us a little bit of background about what you have discovered, some of the main themes that you have found in religious rhetoric going back to the founding era, which I would consider to be, what, probably a decade or so before the American Revolution, maybe going back to the First Great Awakening and then through the first or second decade of the 19th century. So where are some of the themes there?
Well, We're clear here, when I speak of the founding era, I usually tell my students, I'm talking here roughly about the last third or so of the 18th century. We might start a little bit more specifically with the Stamp Act crisis in the mid-1760s. So that's sort of what the time period that I have in mind. But I think your question really invites us to go back to an even earlier portion of American history. Let's remind ourselves that those New England colonies, especially going back to the early 17th century, were started as Bible commonwealths. These were founded by pilgrims, followed by the Puritans who came to the New World to establish polities that were consistent with their understanding of biblical law. And so these were cultures that were steeped in the Bible, and biblical language permeates their rhetoric and their writings, both oral and spoken. And I think we're going to see this, with some minor waxing and waning, continue right through the American founding era, and it's going to continue even beyond that, well into the 19th century. So one of the things I would point to as consistent themes is we're talking about an American culture made up of people from the 1620s right up until the age of Lincoln and beyond, who were a biblically literate people. They knew their Bible, and the Bible becomes a very valuable storehouse for a variety of literary tools. So they could make references to biblical allusions. They could draw on the Bible for figures of speech, metaphors, aphorisms, proverbs. They could draw on the stories of the Bible to illustrate points that they want to make. And again, this is true from the Puritan Commonwealth right into the 19th century. Let's also remember that these are a people who are by and large Protestants. At the time of independence in 1776, I think we could say probably about 98% of all Americans of European descent would have identified with some Protestant church. And so they come out of this culture that does value the Bible. Let's remember, one of the rallying cries of the Protestant Reformation was sola scriptura, scripture alone and faith and practice. So this is a culture that values and elevates the Bible. And again, this is an apt description of American culture. Now, I'm not, of course, making the claim that all Americans were Christians and were people of virtue and so on. I'm not making that claim. I'm talking here more generally about the culture. And one last element that I would point to, and it's not distinct from these previous points, is that beginning with the Puritans, and this continues right through the founding era and well into the 19th century, is that there is a large percentage of Americans who think of themselves as God's new Israel. And again, this is a reference to the Old Testament and the story of the children of Israel fleeing from bondage into freedom in the Promised Land. And this is a motif that is going to be a defining motif in how Americans think of themselves. And again, this is a motif that draws explicitly on Scripture. And one of the things that always surprises me is how even among the most founding figures most influenced by the Enlightenment, they nonetheless bought into this narrative of God's new Israel. And let me give you just one illustration. On July 4th, 1776, a day we generally associate with something else, the Second Continental Congress appointed a committee of three men to design a great seal for the United States. And this was a committee made up of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. These are not your most Bible-believing founding figures. And yet, what did they come up with? They came up with a design that showed Moses extending his hand over the Red Sea, parting it to allow the children of Israel to escape bondage in Egypt. And I think it's quite remarkable that they're drawn to this image as an apt description of the plight of their nation at this point. And I would add one other thing. They put in the background that pillar of cloud and fire that directed it. Divinely directed the children of Israel into the next stage of their existence. So we're talking about a culture that is very much familiar with the language, the stories, the figures of speech of the Christian scriptures.
Now, you mentioned three of the founders who were most influenced by Enlightenment thinking. That's Adams, Jefferson, and Franklin. I suppose we could throw in Madison and a few others, the names that loom large in American history of that period of time. And it gives the image that, well, you know, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, we were going through a different phase of our historical development that seemed to downplay the role of religion. And Jefferson is often talked about as being a deist, and there's a lot of discussion of whether or not they were very religious to begin with at all. And this is a topic that both you and one of our frequent guests, Mark David Hall, have talked about quite a bit. Could you give us a little bit of commentary on to what extent was the culture at that time very deistically oriented, or was it still firmly Christian, and were there a number of other founding fathers and important figures that were still steeped in deep biblical Protestant language?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question and one worth pondering. You know, if you asked the typical American, you know, who are the founding fathers, those who are capable of a response would typically go to, oh, four or five, maybe six figures. And you've just named the most frequent of those. But we forget that the project of the American founding was a collaborative effort. And I think of the founding fathers as those who began to agitate for their full rights as Englishmen and failing to convince Crown and Parliament that they are entitled to their rights as natural-born Englishmen, then began to fight for independence, and having secured independence, then establish new constitutional republics. And this is a project that's going to take a generation or two of Americans. They're going to come from all walks of life. It's going to include people in multiple legislative bodies, from constitutional conventions to state ratifying conventions to denominational bodies and the like, who are all working together for this goal. And I think we do an injustice to our understanding of the founding if we focus on just, you know, a handful of figures. And it doesn't escape my notice that we are most drawn to, in our own age, here in the 21st century, to those founding figures that were perhaps most rationalist, the most influenced by the Enlightenment. And I suspect that's because they seem most like who we are today. Not so much because there weren't pious Christians among the founders who were very influential, but rather we're drawn to those who think and speak in ways that are most recognizable to us in the late 20th and now 21st century. And I think if we're going to have an honest appraisal of who played an important role in the American founding, what they contributed to the American founding, we have to expand our conversation far beyond just those, you know, four or five founding figures. And we have to include people like a Roger Sherman, who our friend Mark Hall has written about. We have to include people like Patrick Henry and John Jay and Gouverneur Morris, and the list goes on. Elias Boudinot, founder of the American Bible Society, and the list goes on and on. Many of these, not all, but many of these were very pious men whose view of the world and politics was shaped by Christianity in general, by the Bible more particularly, and they wanted to bring those values. Now, some of them speak in a biblical language that seems foreign to us today, and I think that's why we oftentimes overlook them. But I think if we're going to truly understand the legal, the cultural, the political milieu of the late 18th century, we have to include a much larger company of men and women who contributed to the American founding than simply to focus on a Jefferson or Franklin or a Madison. As important as they are, we have to include some of these other figures.
And one of the things we've been doing here on Research on Religion, especially around our July 4th episodes, is to feature some of these individuals who aren't talked about very much. And so we'll refer people back to some of those. Mark David Hall and a few other folks have chimed in on some of these figures as well. And it's important here, I think, for Lincoln, too, because Lincoln is born into this era. He's born just in the first decade of the 19th century, I think 1809 he's born. And he's hearing these folks. I mean, today, 150, 200 years later, we forget about all these individuals who were very popular at the time. Our historical understanding is filtered down to 4, 5, or 6 individuals. But Lincoln is probably hearing a conversation that is much broader, and it fulfills our understanding of how he is thinking as well.
Yes. Let me just add to that, Tony, that Lincoln is born in the heartland of America. In fact, it was at the time sort of the western part of the nation. And he's born when the flames of what we sometimes call the second great awakening are really beginning to sort of flourish. And not only is he born when the Second Great Awakening is taking off, he's born in a part of the country which really gave birth to the Second Great Awakening. We think of the very end of the 1790s, but more importantly, the early 1800s, in places like Eastern Kentucky, Cane Ridge, those kind of places, is where the Great Awakening took off. And this is where Abraham Lincoln was born, and this is sort of what informs his childhood and his mindset. So it's hard to imagine that he escaped notice of this profound religious experience that was taking place right around where he was born and grew up.
And give us a little bit of background, too, of this period of time. Let's say he's coming of age in the second, third, fourth decades of the 19th century. This is also an era of manifest destiny. The country is growing, expanding, moving westward. I can imagine that there are biblical themes that are still circulating here that are very reminiscent of the 1600s and 1700s.
Yes, I think that's right. And again, we've just referenced this profound religious revival that's sweeping across the country, and most especially in the very place where Lincoln was born. But we can also draw connections here, and that is, let's look at his father for a moment. His father, Thomas Lincoln, he was a descendant of Puritans. He traced his lineage right back to the Puritans. Now, Thomas was a rather simple farmer, not a wealthy man by any means, and there he is out there on the frontier, which is essentially the frontier at that time, trying to scrape together a living with a growing family. But what we know of Thomas, and again, this is Lincoln's father, is that he was a very pious man. And he was a leader not only in his very local church, but in the movement of his church, beyond the literal four walls of his church to a sort of a growing group of what we might call primitive Baptists. And perhaps reflecting that Puritan heritage, Thomas was a Calvinist. Today we don't always associate Baptists with Calvinism because a large part of the Baptist community has moved away from that. But the particular Baptist community where Abraham Lincoln grew up was not only profoundly devout, but very Calvinist in its orientation. And I think we're going to see that influence to some extent throughout Lincoln's life. It's often said by biographers that Lincoln grew up in a family where every time the church doors were open, the Lincoln family was there. And so, again, that's part of the culture that shaped the character of the young boy, Abraham Lincoln. Now, biographers often tell us and suggest that, that Lincoln, as he moves into young adulthood, perhaps was somewhat skeptical of the claims, the central miraculous claims of Christianity. Perhaps he doubted or questioned some of the core tenets, again, those core tenets that require some belief in the supernatural. One of the things I find somewhat amusing, just to imagine in my mind, it's often said that Lincoln loved to mimic the itinerant preachers that would pass through his church. And apparently he had a great gift for impersonation. And it's often said that he could just get all his fellow friends just rolling with his imitations of preachers, perhaps with a hint of ridicule there. But again, this was a man who grew up in the church. He understood the doctrines of the church, and it was very much a part of his childhood and shaped who he was as an adult.
So it's not surprising that as a late teenager and an early young adult that he would be making fun of church leaders, and then he develops a little bit of skepticism about his religious upbringing, because that's basically every teenager and young adult.
Sure.
But there, you put your finger on something here, is that we oftentimes hear some historical debate about how religious Lincoln really was. In his adulthood, hasn't there been some discussion that he might have drifted away from the church, or he was very private, he wasn't a church-going type of individual? What's the story here?
Yeah, I think it is sometimes hard to get into the heart and mind of a person and understand sort of their religious orientation and the pull of the spiritual on them. And Lincoln, I think, is a particularly difficult figure, somewhat enigmatic in this regard. And I think what you've said is what I've often heard, is as he grew older, he drifted away from the church and perhaps moved more towards sort of that Enlightenment rationalist influence that we were talking about earlier in connection with a Thomas Jefferson. On the other hand, it's often said that at the very end of his life, there seems to be a genuine renewed interest in matters of faith and his relationship with God and the church, perhaps brought on by the tragic death of one or more of his children, just really forced him to reflect deeply on his relationship with God and the place of God in the life of an individual such as himself, as well as in the life of a community. And so there have been those who have argued that there is something of a renewed interest in these matters towards the end of his life.
And it seems fairly typical for a lot of individuals, so Lincoln probably is not very different in terms of this. But he does lead a very different life, because he eventually ends up as being president, and not many of us get to do that. So let's kind of follow his career here. Politically, he is dipping his toes into the political water in the 1840s. I think he has a very short stint as a representative in the U.S. House from Illinois, and then tries to campaign for Senate, the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates. What is going on in his life, and is there any hint that religion and the religious rhetoric is playing a role in his political outlook, his political development, or his political rhetoric?
Yeah. Well, let's step back again, if we can, to his childhood. It seems to me, and I think this is almost certainly true, that Lincoln, like so many young people of his class, of the part of the country where he was raised, almost certainly learned to read with a King James Bible opened in front of him. And so one of the things we can say with certainty is that this was a man who knew the Bible, and he knew the specific language of this translation of the Bible that we call the King James Bible. Now, the King James Bible was commissioned, as you will recall, by King James I of England in the very early 1600s. It was produced and released in 1611. And by the time we get to the mid-17th century, it has become the dominant English language translation of the Bible in America. And it's going to be dominant well into, I would say, the early to mid-20th century. So not only Lincoln, but those around him would have been not only familiar with the Bible, but they would have been familiar with a specific translation of the Bible, the King James Bible. And not only did he learn to read in all likelihood with this book in front of him, but it, I think, shaped the way he framed language. It shaped, the way in which he spoke. And so I think what we're going to see is, as he begins to embark first on a legal career and then a political career, he's going to be a person who speaks, if I may put it this way, the language of the King James Bible. This is the lingua franca of his culture and his generation. So he's not alone in that respect, but he's particularly adept at the use of this peculiar language that we associate with the King James Bible. And so I think we are in fact going to see this in his public speeches and the like.
Just as a side note, as somebody who uses more modern interpretations of the Bible in my own studies, what is distinct about the King James Version that somebody could go back and look and not necessarily see phrases explicitly from the King James Bible, but say, ah, this person was influenced by that type of style?
Yes. Well, I think it has a very distinct sort of rhythm to this language. It's the language of the late, I would say, late Elizabethan, early Jacobean period in England. It's the language that we associate with Shakespeare, if you will. And I place the sort of the birth of this language somewhat earlier. Yes, it's Elizabethan, Jacobean English, but I think it has its roots in the early 1500s in the work of what I regard to be the greatest Bible translator in the English speaking world, a man by the name of Tyndale. And at great personal cost, in fact it cost him his life, he embarked on an endeavor to translate the scriptures into the English language. And he set before him the task of writing the language, the writing this translation in a language, and again, this is his expression, a language that could be read and understood by the humble plowboy. Mm-hmm. So this is a language for the common man, the working man. This is not the highbrow language of educated elites. And as a consequence, it's often said that Tyndale was drawn to words that had more of an Anglo-Saxon root to them, as opposed to the language of more educated elites, which would have had a Latin flavor to it, Latinate words. And so the Anglo-Saxon words are sharp, they're crisp, and they seem to have this very distinctive beat to it. And of course, not only is Tyndale using the language that could be understood by the common man, but he's choosing a language to be read aloud. He's preparing a Bible, not only for the humble plowboy, but a Bible that can be read aloud. And so it has the lyrical rhythms of something that is read, for an entire congregation. Now, virtually every subsequent translator of the Bible in the English language until we get to the 20th century are going to borrow in great measure from Tyndale's work. And that includes the translators of the King James Bible. It is heavily influenced by Tyndale. And so you have this this language, again, informed by Anglo-Saxon origins, designed to be read aloud, and of course, the translation work is just masterful in its figures of speech and its metaphors. You know, Tyndale had to create words that didn't exist in the English language just so that he could translate portions of the scripture. He had to certainly develop a grammar and things like that. And so you're going to see that influence continue right through the translation of the King James Bible and even subsequent translations of the Bible in the English language.
And this seems to be just ideal for Abraham Lincoln, who has that plowboy background. He's not part of the educated elite of the time. We often see pictures of him chopping wood. So this is the plowboy that I think would resonate with him and his rhetoric connecting to this kind of cadence that Kendall had used would probably be very perfectly suited for him.
Yeah, I've never thought of it quite that way, but I think that's a wonderful insight, Tony. Abraham Lincoln is who Tyndale had in mind when he embarked on his translation. You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful insight.
So let's talk about his movement into political career and how he starts to use, or doesn't use perhaps, religious rhetoric. He is coming of age politically at a time where the abolitionist movement is really taking a firm hold here. Slavery is a large issue. It's a huge moral issue. It involves a lot of religious dialogue and rhetoric. And it's a time when the nation is starting to see rifts. And as we know, it's going to become a very large rift in the Civil War. But early on in his career, do we see any evidence of the use of religious rhetoric back then?
Certainly. Let's just make this point. I think from the very beginning of his public career to the very end, Lincoln is masterful in his use of language. And the language he speaks is this language of the King James Bible. So you're going to hear those rhythms, those cadences. You're going to encounter phrases that are biblical in nature, or certainly are biblical-like in nature, in Lincoln's speech. And we're going to see that throughout, from beginning to end. Now, we're also going to see at moments where he's using specific biblical quotations or biblical texts explicate some point that he wants to make. I think it's fair to say that he does that no better than what he did in the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural. But we're gonna see moments of his more obvious use of the Bible very, very early on. So let's take, for example, a speech that's sometimes called the Young Men's Lyceum speech that he gives in Springfield in 1838. I start here because the speech was published in the local newspaper and it was widely distributed, and this really establishes Lincoln's reputation as a gifted orator. It's a speech about the founder's vision of Republican self-government and liberty under law, and he's very concerned, as you just pointed out, about the rifts that he sees tearing apart the fabric of American life, especially over the issue of slavery. And in this speech, he's concerned about the corrupting, corrosive effect of slavery on the rule of law. And you see that kind of Bible-like language from time to time in this speech. But I would note that he ends the speech. The very end of the speech is a direct quotation from the book of Matthew. He's quoting Matthew chapter 16, where he's talking about this love of liberty and the perpetuation of liberty, and he says, "The gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And of course, that is, he puts it in quotation marks, sort of tipping us off that these are words that come from a different source. The source, of course, was the book of Matthew. We see this moving forward, getting closer to his presidential career, when he gives a famous political convention speech I believe it's in 1858, you may want to correct me here, a speech that we sometimes call the House Divided speech. And again, he's looking at how slavery is tearing the nation apart, and you can see on the horizon this civil war that's going to tear the nation apart. And very early in the speech, he begins with a quotation from Matthew chapter 12, verse 25, where he speaks of a house divided against itself cannot stand. And what a powerful metaphor. It strikes me that in that simple biblical metaphor of a house divided, he describes the precarious place of the nation much more effectively than he could have through a very wordy dissertation. But again, that's the kind of language that Lincoln used so effectively. In a simple metaphor, house divided, he captures this precarious predicament the nation finds itself in.
And that predicament really comes to the fore right when he's elected. I mean, this is a president who falls into a period of tragedy almost immediately as he's elected, and South Carolina quickly secedes about a month or so later after the election and before he's inaugurated. And so this has to weigh very heavily on his mind. And so the lighthearted themes of manifest destiny and we're seeing the promised land in front of us are probably going to be clouded by the country or the house being divided amongst itself. And how does this influence his speech? We're going to talk about Gettysburg and the second inaugural in just a moment here, but we don't hear much about the first inaugural. What is going on with the first inaugural, and was there much religious rhetoric in there? Was biblical themes coming up?
Yes. From my recollection of the first inaugural, I don't recall him ever directly quoting from Scripture. Again, he uses that language with the rhythms of the King James Bible throughout. But it's a much more workmanlike speech, if I may use that phrase, compared to the second inaugural address. He's in the first inaugural, he's dealing with a legal constitutional crisis. And it's a workmanlike speech dealing with the exigencies of that moment. Now, by the time he gives the second inaugural, the war has almost has almost wound down completely. Not quite, but almost wound down. And I think it's an opportunity for more reflection, for deep thought and reflection in the second inaugural. We don't see quite that in the first inaugural. It does have its occasional moments of great rhetorical flourish. I would draw your attention to that final paragraph. It's a wonderful final paragraph in the first inaugural, where he says, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies." And he talks about the mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave, et cetera, et cetera. You know, wonderful rhetoric. He ends the speech by talking about the better angels of our nature. So there are these wonderful, rare moments of rhetorical flourish. I don't think it's quite the same type of speech rhetorically that we're going to hear a few years later at Gettysburg, and then 4 years later in the second inaugural. But I think he's dealing with a very specific constitutional crisis, and he wants to explain where he stands legally, where he stands constitutionally, where he stands politically, rather than sort of these more generalized reflections on who we are, where we come from, where we're going.
Yeah, and he's brand new to the job as well, too. And you're moving into the White House, and you're having to deal with the country that elected you falling apart. And so I can imagine that you didn't have a whole lot of time for great deep reflection. And it might also be the case that as the nation falls apart and we enter into one of the bloodiest conflicts of our history, that, you know, a lot more heavy reflection is piling upon him. And as the war progresses, this must occupy all of his time and attention. We get to the point of Gettysburg, which is the turning point of the Civil War. And at that time, it might not have been that absolutely clear, but we do know that it was today a very critical battle where things could have gone one way or the other. And a few months, I believe it was about a month and a half after the battle had ended, Lincoln goes to Pennsylvania and basically to consecrate a burial ground, to basically honor the dead that fought there, and gives this very short speech. And this is one of the most iconic speeches in American history. Grade schoolers are required to memorize it because, one, it's very short, but also it's very poignant as well. Tell us about the Gettysburg Address. How was it written? Why was it written? Why was he giving it? And fill us in on some of the biblical insights. You wrote a very interesting piece that we will link to that really highlights a lot of things that I had known a little bit about, but really kind of surprised me in many other aspects.
Well, you're right. Gettysburg, the battle, is really, I think, the turning point in the war. The battle itself is the first 3 days in July. I think the timing is significant. July 1, 2, and 3, the victory's won July 4th. I think there's some symbolic significance to that that we can talk about. And Lincoln was very much aware of the symbolic significance of the battle is over July 4th. But the carnage of the battle is just horrific, just horrific. It's my recollection that I think, am I correct in saying 8,000 lives were lost in those 3 days? I may be wrong in that number, but something like that. And that's not even talking about the casualties short of death. Thousands and thousands of lives were devastated in a physical sense by that battle, and so a decision's made is to turn this into this battlefield into a hallowed resting place for the dead, and it is I think 4.5 months later,
okay,
on November 19th, that Lincoln takes that short train ride from the capital, Washington, up to Gettysburg. There is a myth that he kind of scribbled this on the back of an envelope on the train. I think that probably doesn't do it justice. It's very clear to me that he was thinking about the themes of this address, working on it long before he got on that train, And let's be very clear here. Lincoln, I think, is a gifted writer, but he oftentimes labored very long over his words. So these weren't just words that just flew free-form from his mouth, but he often labored over important speeches. And I think he thought of this as an important speech. He knew he wasn't the top bill of the day, president though he was. There was another speaker who was sort of billed as the chief orator of the day. But he was there to offer his dedicatory comments on that occasion. And again, I think the evidence suggests that he went through multiple drafts. He was the kind of orator who one gets the sense that he would deliver the lines out loud because he wanted to get a sense of how the words sounded in their oral presentation. And again, his greatest speeches, the Gettysburg and the second inaugural, they just have this wonderful lyrical quality to the language that one gets by hearing the language as much as one gets from simply reading them on a piece of paper. So there's no doubt that he labored long over these words. And as I say in my piece, the Gettysburg Address is replete with biblical language. And I would also say biblical themes. But what's fascinating, and this is what first drew me to this speech for my current research interests, is that there's no place in the Gettysburg Address where one gets the sense that he's deliberately quoting the Bible for the Bible's sake. Rather, he's using Bible-like language for its rhetorical impact. So for a Bible-reading language to hear that those rhythms, those cadences, those phrases of the King James Bible, in and of itself, lends a kind of weightiness, a seriousness to what it is that Lincoln's saying. So, again, he's not using the Bible to quote a particular passage per se, but he's using this distinctive language to capture his audience's attention, to make them aware of the significance, the moral implications, the sacred connotations of what it is that he wants to talk about. And he does this from the very opening line. So he begins by saying 67 years ago. Now, if my math is correct, he could have opened by saying 87 years ago, right? Rather prosaic by comparison to the words that he chose. But why does he say 67 years? Well, I think, and I'm certainly not alone in making this observation, but I think he's drawing on a familiar mode of expression for counting the number of years that one finds in the Bible. The most famous is found in Psalm 90:10, where it talks about the number of years that a man has on this earth, and it says 70. And that, so that form of expressing the number of years, Lincoln borrows here, and for a Bible reading audience, I think from the very first words, he's put his audience in a biblical frame of mind. He said, folks, I've got something serious to say here. This is a solemn occasion, and these are solemn words that I want to communicate. But he doesn't stop there. He goes from 67 years ago to the next phrase is, our fathers. Now, when I hear that phrase, our fathers, I'm immediately drawn to the Lord's Prayer that we read in Matthew chapter 6, our Father which art in heaven. But he doesn't stop there. He goes, 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth. Now, brought forth, again, is biblical language. You can find that phrase, brought forth, over and over and over again in the King James Bible. Brought forth is the language that we find in Genesis to describe the creation. It's the language that we find over and over again in the Hebrew Scriptures to describe the actions of Moses. Moses brought forth the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage. It's also the language that we find in Matthew to describe Mary, who brought forth a child, the Christ child. And so he's using language, phrase upon phrase, that is evocative of the language of the King James Bible. And I think this is going to continue throughout the speech.
Yeah, it was very interesting reading your piece, because, again, as somebody who had to memorize the speech when I was in grade school, you get this notion that, well, that's how everybody talked at that day, and you never really think about these issues. And what you do very nicely in the piece is to point out that, yeah, this is in the King James Bible, and Lincoln is so steeped in it, and he's talking to an audience that is going to be steeped in it, and he's talking to plowboys as well. He's talking to America, which is a nation of plowboys, and it just resonates so well in terms of you know, what you also talk about, the cadence. And I had never even thought about the cadence until you had mentioned it in this article, but it does ring like a, you know, biblical sermon.
Yes, yes. I think we can regard these as almost political sermons. And people at the time noted that. Yes, this is a very common mode of speech at the time among gifted orators, but not all. There are other sources that a gifted orator could turn to. We can find some orators are turning to the ancients and to the rhetoric of the great Greek and Roman poets and things like that, drawing on their modes of speech. I don't think that influence is found as frequently in American political discourse as frequently as the Bible, but there's other sources that we can turn to. But what I would say is Lincoln is not alone in this respect, but he's probably the most adept in using biblical language and Bible-like language for rhetorical effect. He's the master of this particular kind of expression.
Now, I have to ask a little bit of a methodological question. And it's what I call the Beatles' Paul is Dead question. When you're looking at this thing 150 years after it has been written, it's possibly easy to go back, and for a scholar who's very interested in finding religious rhetoric in any kind of political speech, to go find this stuff. You can listen to Beatles lyrics and figure out, oh yeah, there's all these clues that Paul is dead. To what extent are we looking at it with 2020 hindsight and reading more into it than might be justified?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer. There are, I think, a lot of other expressions in the Gettysburg Address, for example, and we find other examples in the second inaugural that certainly line up with the same phrases as used in the King James Bible. Phrases like a resting place, in vain, from the earth, shall not perish. These are all phrases that Lincoln uses, and I think it's certainly possible that he used these phrases without deliberately saying, now what's a good biblical phrase that I can insert here? Again, I think that's just very much part of who he is, and it goes back to that childhood. Someone who learned to read and speak with the King James Bible and opened in front of him. So I think it's certainly true that some of these phrases are just part of his vocabulary, and he uses them without thinking about their biblical connection. On the other hand, I think that it's not coincidental, it seems to me, that he is starting out the speech with these very evocative biblical phrases, because he knows that this is the kind of language that has an effect on a pious Bible reading public. Now, I would add to that, Tony, and I think this is where it gets much more serious. I think not only is Lincoln using the biblical phrases here for rhetorical effect, he's also going to draw on biblical themes. And so I think that he is very deliberately laying out a theme in the Gettysburg Address that is biblical in nature. And when you combine his playing off biblical themes with biblical language, I think the argument that he uses these biblical phrases deliberately, to me, becomes much more persuasive. And the underlying theme of the Gettysburg Address, as I see it, and I think we could have a spirited debate about this, but I think the central theme of the Gettysburg Address is the conception, birth, death, and rebirth of the nation. And of course, he's playing off this central theme of the Gospels. In the conception, birth, and the atoning death of Jesus Christ, which gives us a hope of a new birth, a rebirth. And so there he is on Gettysburg's blood-soaked battlefield. And let's picture this. As he speaks, in front of him were undoubtedly men with legs that were not there anymore, with limbs that were lost in the battle. There were the families of men who could not be there because they are now buried. And what is he saying? By playing off this theme of conception, birth, death, and new birth, he's saying, your sons, your husbands, your fathers shed their blood so that this nation could have a new birth of freedom, just like Jesus shed his blood on Calvary's cross so that we could all have a new birth in a spiritual sense. And it's a powerful, powerful picture. But you can see how it must have resonated with the audience that he had literally in front of him on that November morning.
It not only resonated with the folks at the time, but again, looking back at this after a century and a half, one cannot help but see the providential nature of Lincoln himself in this. Because as we know, he doesn't know at the time, but as we know, he will be assassinated basically near the end of the Civil War. And the fact that he came at this one point in time in history and really bore the sins of a nation during this short period of time, a very difficult period of time, and then dies in such a bloody way to give rebirth to a unified nation again. It just seems more than coincidental.
Well, it's certainly an interesting sort of a narrative that's being played out here.
Yeah.
Let me just mention one other thing here that we alluded to earlier in this program, and that is, I think Lincoln also is playing off here the fact that Gettysburg's victory is fully appreciated on the morning of July 4th, and so again, this plays off the new birth theme because. He begins the speech by pointing us to 87 years earlier. And what is he referencing? He's referencing July 4th, 1776. He says, "This nation was born on July 4th, 1776, but it was born in sin. It was born in the sin of slavery." Let's consider the man who wrote those words that we celebrate on July 4th, 1776. This is a man who had hundreds of slaves himself, Thomas Jefferson. And so he says, "We were born in sin, but through the shed blood and death of these brave men of this great Civil War, we have a hope for a new birth through the abolition of slavery, and the reunification of this nation. We have a hope for a new birth, for a new nation." And so I think we could rightly regard the Gettysburg Address as Abraham Lincoln's 4th of July oration. Now, let me also remind you that not only was the victory fully appreciated on July 4th, 1863, but on July 4th, 1863, that same day is the day that Vicksburg fell, and that signaled a significant turning point also, this time in the battle to the west on the Mississippi River. And so he sees July 4th as the nation's new birth. 1776 was the original birth, but this is the new birth of a nation shed of that besetting sin of slavery.
Let's move on to the second inaugural address, because now he has, Gettysburg is basically the center point, or a little bit past the halfway mark of the war. The second inaugural address, how does it differ in its use of God talk, so to speak?
Well, it does differ, and that's important to point out. Not only do we find some phrases in the second inaugural that are Bible-like in the sense that we were talking about with the Gettysburg Address, but it's different in this respect, and that is Lincoln very deliberately uses direct quotations from Scripture. He's going specifically to the Bible, using the Bible for what the text is teaching us to make his points, to advance his argument in the second inaugural. And there are at least four very direct quotations from the Bible in the second inaugural. And I would say that no president before or since has used the Bible more extensively or substantively in an inaugural address than Abraham Lincoln does on this day. And his use of the Bible is absolutely essential to the mission and the message of the occasion of this day, the second inaugural.
Go ahead and into the themes of this, and how does he use the Bible more explicitly, and is this part of the meta theme that you were talking about in the Gettysburg Address of conception, birth, and death and resurrection or rebirth?
Well, not exactly. I don't think he's playing off that same theme here. And about halfway through, now let's just sort of set the stage here. The war is going to be over in any meaningful sense in just a matter of days. We're talking literally within a week. The war is pretty much going to be over except for the few odd holdouts, in far-flung forests. But the war is essentially over. And one might expect that a president, after a very long, arduous, costly war, might use this occasion to give a victory speech. you might expect him perhaps to sort of lay out a plan for where do we go from here? What's going to be the program of reconstruction? But you don't quite get that here. What you get in the second inaugural is a very deep reflection on the will of God, the providence of God. How does one account for God's intervention in the affairs of nations? And the speech has this wonderful sort of outline. It begins with a discussion of where we've been. How did this war come about? He tells us the war comes about because of slavery. That's a debatable point that people still debate today, but he tells us he thinks the war comes from slavery. And then about halfway through the speech, he has this very interesting line. He says, both the North and the South read the same Bible, and both pray to the same God, and each side asks for God's help, God's aid, in this manner. Now, I think that line is the turning point in the speech. Now he's going to reflect on where we are right now, okay? Our present predicament, and this is the beginning of sort of his reflection on how are we in this moment right now. And very interestingly, having made that observation about both sides read the same Bible, he then turns to Scripture. And he says this, it may seem strange that any men would dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. Now, the sweat of other men's faces is a line that comes out of Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. And this particular passage is of course the great chapter in the Bible that describes the fall of man and what is the punishment for that sin in the Garden of Eden. God tells Adam, you're going to have to, for the rest of your days, earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. Right? So he's quoting Genesis chapter 3, and he says, we have a sin. We've got to confront a sin. But he rewrites that passage slightly to turn it from simply a description of the consequences of man's sin in the garden to highlight the great sin of slavery. So he says the sin here is wringing one's bread from the sweat of other men's faces. That's the sin of slavery. Now, he doesn't linger long here because he very quickly in the next clause says, but let us judge not that we be not judged. And that comes from the Sermon on the Mount. That's the famous instruction of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. And I think this is, now he's turned looking forward to reconciliation. Now, he begins the next paragraph by saying the Almighty has his own purposes. Now he's about ready to delve into this serious reflection on the role of providence, the role of God in the affairs of men and nations. He says, the Almighty has his own purposes. And then what does he follow that up with? But with another quote, direct quote, in quotation marks, I might add, from the book of Matthew, another one of Jesus' sayings where Jesus says, woe unto the world because of offenses, or we might say sins, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. So what is he saying here? I think he says, we of a nation have sinned, the sin of slavery. And there's consequences for that sin. There's woe that's going to come because of that sin. Now, again, if Lincoln was in a gloating mode because the war has been won, you might expect him to say, you know, you guys down there in the South, you're going to pay a terrible price for this sin. But no, that's not what he says. He goes on to say there is this offense of American slavery. That's his phrase, American slavery. And I think that's significant because he's not placing blame just on the South. But he's saying this is a sin that we have all partaken in. And we are all going to suffer the consequences of that sin. And then he tells us what he thinks are the consequences, which is this war, this terrible war that we've just suffered is God's woe, God's punishment for this sin of slavery. Now, the costs of this war are incalculable. We don't have to go through that again. Maybe as many as 750,000 men lost their lives. It's a horrible cost for this sin of slavery. But lest we think that God is unjust, or being unfair because we've had to pay this terrible price for the offense of slavery. He then ends that paragraph by drawing us to Psalm 19, verse 19, where he says, "The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." And so, who are we to question or doubt how God serves his purposes? We're getting what we deserve here, folks. So, again, he's using Scripture here in ways that are absolutely essential to the point that he wants to make.
To what extent, and you brought up the term providence here, and providence has been a theme in religious rhetoric, as you mentioned, dating back to the Pilgrims, to the Puritans. To what extent in this speech does Lincoln still see the United States as a providential and blessed nation?
I think that's a really hard question to answer, and one I don't really think I'm competent to answer, and maybe no one is. I do think he thinks that we are a nation who is answerable to the God of the Bible. Otherwise, I don't think he would be using this language. Mm-hmm. And this, let's not make any mistake here. He is referring, I think, to the God of the Bible. So in that sense, yes, you know, we are a nation governed by providence in that sense. But, you know, I don't know. And there are other hints in other places in Lincoln's writings that suggest that he's not totally comfortable with that old Puritan language of the New Israel. Mm-hmm. Remember a famous line he used, an almost chosen nation, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So there are these hints that Lincoln may not be totally comfortable with that kind of Puritan-like rhetoric. But there's no doubt, in my mind at least, that he sees that we are a people that are under the overruling, superintending providence of the God of the Bible.
One of the questions I want to end off with is a question I often ask of the scholars who appear on this show, is a reflective question, and to have you think a little bit about what you've learned over the course of your studies that might apply to today or for a new understanding that you have of history or of our contemporary lives. And given that your main specialty has been the founding era, but you've decided to extend yourself broader into American history and to look at some of these speeches by Lincoln, but you're also a person who lives in Washington, D.C. today, and we're told that the nation is rift asunder with political conflict as well, and we face a variety of other sins that people always remind us of. What have you learned through the process of looking at Lincoln's writings and thinking about this?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that politicians, even in our own time, make frequent reference and allusion to Scripture. Just look at the two relatively short inaugural addresses that George W. Bush gave, and there are a number of references to the Bible, allusions. In his first inaugural speech, he talks about how we need to be a nation that doesn't cross over to the other side and leave the needy lying in the ditch, in a clear reference to the story of the Good Samaritan. And he makes a number of other biblical allusions in that speech, as well as his second inaugural. Our current president made a reference to a biblical aphorism in his first inaugural address. And it reminds me that even in our profoundly secular age, religious language, especially language from the Bible, can be enormously powerful in our political rhetoric. And so I encourage our listeners just to keep their ears open for that language. But when looking at religious language, I think we have to ask, it's not enough to simply say, oh, there's a biblical reference or there's a biblical allusion. I think we have to go deeper, and we have to ask, why is this language being used? What's the purpose for this use of the Bible or Bible-like language? And there's a variety of uses that one can make of Scripture, from merely using it as a literary, for purpose of a literary allusion, to something much more theological, which I think is what Lincoln does in the second inaugurals. He looks to the Bible to help gain insights on the ways of God, the character of God. So I think we need to ask ourselves, why is the Bible being used? Because I think it can be very misleading, Tony, to read spiritual meaning into purely literary or political uses of the Bible. But the opposite is true as well. I think it's an equal mistake to sort of look at a politician who uses biblical language and say, oh, that's just politics, without attempting to see if this is a speaker who's trying to draw out something of a spiritual moment or gain a spiritual insight or theological insight. So I think it's very important that when we hear this kind of language, and I've certainly become attuned to this in recent years, when we hear this language is to sort of ask ourselves, why is the speaker drawing on religious themes or on biblical language? What are they hoping to achieve? And I think that there are legitimate uses of this kind of language. I think it's also a tool that can be used in perhaps illegitimate ways, simply to manipulate a pious public. So we have to be very attuned to these things.
Well, I think that is a wonderful lesson to conclude on, and what we try to do here at Research on Religion is to always get people tuned in to those messages and think deeper about the spiritual, political, and social landscape that we live in. My guest today has been Daniel Dreinsback. Daniel, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.